let me just report again some truisms that you would read all over the front pages of the newspapers if there was any commitment to trying to tell important and uncontroversial truths. There's nothing I'm going to say that's in the least controversial. But let me just run through the history because it's interesting. Cuba was the first foreign policy problem for the United States. It goes back to the 1820s. This is no new thing. Back in the 1820s, the nice guys like Thomas Jefferson and so on, who were planning to take over the hemisphere, you know, saw Cuba as the next place to pick up. Okay, they'd already stolen Florida from its inhabitants, claiming to have taken it from the Spanish, but actually from its inhabitants. And their eyes were now kind of moving toward the west, but also on Cuba. That was the next prize. Well, there was a little problem. The British fleet, you know. There was a British deterrent, just as in the 1960s there was a Soviet deterrent. And in fact, the British were the hated enemy in those days, mainly because of their power. They were preventing the United States from expanding, like they prevented the United States from conquering Canada a couple of times, which the U.S. has been trying to do since 1775. And may have finally achieved in the so-called free trade agreement, Cuba was sitting right there. You know, it's a valuable place. He couldn't get there because the British are in the way. John Quincy Adams, I guess it was, suggested that we just be patient. He said it'll drop into our hands like a ripe fruit by the laws of political gravitation. Okay, meaning by the time we get stronger and the British get weaker, things will shift around, we'll be able to take it over. Okay, by the end of the century that had happened. By the end of the century, the British were sort of being pushed out of the game, the United States was getting more powerful, and during something that is sort of ludicrously mistitled the Spanish-American War, the United States intervened in Cuba primarily to prevent it from liberating itself from Spain. You take a close look. That's an interpretation, so you want to make sure, you know, don't take my word for it. But I think if you look, you'll find that what happened is that the intervention in Cuba was primarily an effort to make sure that its liberation from Spain didn't mean liberation. And in fact, Cuba was quickly turned into an American plantation with all kind of restrictions on its options and, you know, bought up by American agribusiness and so on and so forth. When Cuba tried any funny ideas about moving towards independence, it was smashed down. For example, Franklin Roosevelt is famous for the good neighbor policy. We don't intervene anymore in the affairs of our neighbors. Well, take a look at 1934, when Cuba made the mistake of trying to elect a sort of, I guess, moderate social democrat of more or less independent ideas as president. That's going too far. Okay, so out. So it continues up through 1959. Okay, 1959. Castro comes along. There was a little bit of toying with the question of whether we can maintain the new Cuba in our system or not. And this is not a new policy issue. Remember, it's back to the 1820s, hasn't changed much. Within a couple of months, it was decided that Castro's too big for his britches. There's no Russians, incidentally. He's anti-communist, you know. In fact, he's jailing members of the Communist Party. There was no question of the Russians or the communists or any of this kind of stuff. By late 1959, U.S. planes were already bombing Cuba from Florida bases. The State Department claims they didn't know about it. You know, yeah, sure. Okay, but I mean, try that if, say, Cuban planes bombed the United States, you know, and say, well, okay, the Cubans didn't know about it. Okay, so, but it was happening. In March 1960, the Eisenhower administration made a formal decision. It was secret, but now it's declassified, so you can find out about it. They made the formal decision to overthrow the Cuban government and take it over. Okay, that's March 1960. Remember, no Cold War, no Russians, no communists, just independent Cuba. From that point on, March 1960, up until today, Cuba has been subjected to extensive international terrorism, economic strangulation, without an end. And it's not trivial stuff. Just to give you one small example, this one comes from an absolutely impeccable source, Raymond Garthoff, who's a very conservative and respected historian, right inside the CIA and the intelligence apparatus now, writes historical work on all this stuff. Take a look at his books, on Reflections on the Missile Crisis, which he's writing sort of partially from the inside, partly from as a historian. Well, there's a little item in there somewhere where he's at the peak of the missile crisis, you know, before it, you know, when it had sort of theoretically been solved, but it was still was not over. So, like, the missiles were still there. At the peak of the missile crisis, one of the mongoose teams, these terrorist teams that Kennedy had sent into Cuba to smash the place up, one of them, which was apparently acting out of control at the time, like there's no evidence that Kennedy had ordered it to do this, but so maybe it was on its own, but one of them blew up a petrochemical plant in Cuba, which according to him, he doesn't verify it, but he says it's alleged, and he apparently takes it seriously, that 400 workers were killed. Well, you know, suppose Cuba blew up a factory in the United States and 400 people were killed. Think it might make the newspaper? In fact, they'd probably be nuked. We'd nuke them, you know? Okay, but this is us. And this is, incidentally, one tiny footnote to a long history of terrorism. And this was right at the peak of the missile crisis when, for all I know, Cuba had its fingers on the missiles. I don't know that. But anyway, somebody did. Okay, now, try to just... For those of you who want to know about why people believe what they do, just do a little check and find out how much information you can find out about this, okay? I mean, I've told you, I'll save you the trouble. This is it. I've repeated it in probably 20 times in books that nobody would dream of looking at or reviewing and so on. But that's one little item. And then it goes on to poisoning crops and livestock and shooting down fishing boats and strafing hotels and, you know, blowing up airplanes and all sorts of things. Meanwhile, the economic strangulation goes on, okay, permanently. Now, the only issue debated in the United States, for a long time, there was a pretense we got to do this because of the Russians, okay, because, you know, Cuba is a tentacle of the Russian monster trying to strangle us. I mean, in an intellectually free country, everybody would laugh. In fact, when Kennedy once tried to get the Mexican ambassador to join in some anti-Cuban action back in the early 60s, the Mexican ambassador actually told him, you know, he'd like to do it, but if he announces it in public in Mexico that Cuba's a threat, he said 40 million Mexicans will die laughing, okay? that's basically true. I mean, the idea that Cuba could be a threat even if it's armed by the Russians, I mean, you know, it's as if, I mean, like to try to find, I can't even think of a counterpart, but suppose that before the end of the Cold War, Russia had been carrying out massive terrorism against Denmark and strangling the country. Let's imagine it could do that because it said that Denmark was a threat. Well, you know, Denmark was way more of a threat to Russia than Cuba is to the United States. I mean, Denmark's an advanced industrial country. It's a member of a hostile military alliance, you know, well-armed. I mean, if the Russians had said that, you wouldn't laugh. It would be a sign of their lunacy and, you know, maybe we got to murder them or something like that. But we say that all the time, and that's okay because that's us. You know, we're properly indoctrinated. To judge how much of a Russian threat it was, bear in mind that the formal decision to overthrow the government was taken in March 1960 when there's no Russians. Okay, and it continues under the pretext of a Russian threat as long as the Russians were around. And then what happened when the Russians disappeared? Okay, so November 1989, Berlin Wall falls, no more Russians. What happened to Cuba? I mean, if the story of the last 30 years that we hear from Arthur Schlesinger and everyone was true, well, we should have welcomed Cuba with open arms. No more tentacles of the Russians. Is that what happened? No. We drew the noose tighter. Okay. All of a sudden, it wasn't because the Russians were a threat. It was because we love democracy so much, as you can easily demonstrate by looking at what we do around the world. Okay. But and if you take a look at the educated classes, they didn't skip a beat. From one day to the next, it's defending ourselves against the Russian threat to loving democracy. Okay. With this history out in the open. Now, that's a real achievement. I doubt that a totalitarian state could achieve anything like that. Anyhow, up until now, it's, well, we love democracy so much. And then the only question is, well, what's the best way to achieve democracy? Is it the Helms-Burton Act, or is it by the Canadian Prime Minister going there? You know? And this is discussed as if it was serious. That's the interesting part. I mean, this is discussed as if, you know, it's not 40 million Mexicans die laughing, which it ought to be. You know, it's discussed as if it could conceivably be serious. It can't possibly be serious. The only question is how to make sure that Cuba will go back into the box in which it was supposed to be put in 1820. If they can force it back there by one or another means, fine, we'll accept Cuba. We'll even call it a democracy, and it's run by some brutal murderer, you know, like we call Mexico a democracy, or we call Colombia a democracy. In fact, the best democracy in the hemisphere, even has an independent political party, you know, which was allowed to function in 1985. Since that time, about 3,000 of its activists have been murdered, mostly by security forces and paramilitary forces, including every presidential candidate and most of the mayors. But, you know, it's there. It's got to be a democracy. And since we love democracy so much, we think it's fine. You know. But so maybe if Cuba ends up with a democracy like that, it'll be fine as long as it follows orders. You know, there ought to be 100 million Americans who die laughing over this. And the fact that they're not is an indication of the grip of the doctrinal system, which is really powerful. And in this case, primarily among the more educated sectors. You know, if they don't know these things, it's a conscious decision not to know. It takes work not to know these things. Like, you don't have to, you know, really explore.
Even the battle for the minds of the masses and the fact that it's critical to mobilize those masses to achieve any rights for workers, do you see any solutions short of revolution?
Sure. I mean, the solutions that have worked all through history. I mean, how did workers' rights get established in the, more or less, in the 1930s?
Revolution.
There was no revolution. I mean, there was a threat. There was certainly a threat. Like when working people took over General Motors. Yeah, that's no joke. People got scared. Yeah, okay. Because the next thing they'll come to their heads is, what do we need the bosses for? You know, like, maybe they'll get as smart as the factory girls in Lowell, you know, 150 years ago and say, look, we don't need those guys. We'll run it ourselves. You know? And you got to make sure that that doesn't happen, because that's really trouble. So yes, there was an accommodation. And in fact, right through history, that's the way it's worked. I mean, nowadays, people who consider themselves more or less progressive, whatever that term is supposed to mean, think that they got a pretty rotten life. Look at our problems. Well, you know, there's plenty of problems, but it's a lot better than it was 30 years ago, let alone 50 years ago or 100 years ago. So, like, nowadays, you're worried about how to protect some kind of medical system. Worrying about that 30 years ago? There wasn't any. You know? Or take, say, women's rights. Okay. Plenty of problems about women's rights, like, you know, the way affirmative action is being used to attack people. It wasn't a problem 30 years ago. There were no rights, you know. Issue after issue, it's just things are, over time, you know, the struggles take off from a higher level than before. So, like, the 19th, you think it looks bad for labor now, have a look at the 1920s. You know, the fall of the House of Labor in a most undemocratic America, when workers could do nothing more than try to pursue individual survival strategies. And that, remember, that was the period of mass industrialization, you know, establishment of the automobile industry. It's like not a rural country. Well, what you do is try to keep making things better. Is it a revolution or not? That's kind of like a question of definition. I mean, if it's possible, I mean, I think myself, I agree with those mill hands in Massachusetts that the people who work in the mills ought to own them. Generalized. Well, all right, if there's steps toward that happening, I guess you could call it a revolution, but I don't see why it shouldn't just happen.
I'm referring back to your comments about the media and the great public relations that employ and
right. But see, I think all that stuff is totally illegitimate. I mean, and that goes way back to something much earlier. Why should corporations have any rights at all? Okay, I mean, that's not, like, it's not in the Constitution. You know, corporate rights are the result, it's not even by legislation. I mean, corporate rights were achieved mostly through courts and lawyers, and pretty recently. You know, the main decisions are early in this century. Like, it's not founded, it's not graven in stone or anything like that. Actually, there's pretty good literature on this. If you're interested, the best book is by a Harvard professor that I know, a guy named Morton Horowitz, who's at the law school. Has a couple of books called Transformation of American Law. One of them, I think, goes up till like 1860, and the other from maybe 1860 to 1960. But the main theme of the book, of these two big volumes, I mean, it's interesting reading. You know, it sounds kind of dense and so on, but it's, you find it interesting reading. The main theme is how the legal system was reshaped to accommodate to the needs of private power. Okay? All the way through, that's been the main theme of the legal system, how to modify it so that illegitimate tyrannical authority is given more and more power, undermining democratic principles. That's basically, he didn't say it in those words, but that's what it comes down to. And the big step, you know, the major step probably, was the transfer of rights to private tyrannies, which is what corporations are, early in this century. And as he points out, he doesn't go into it much, this, you really, but I think he's right, this developed out of ideas, kind of Hegelian ideas about the rights of organic entities over individuals, which are also at the roots of Bolshevism and fascism. And I should mention that that comparison is, may sound exotic now, but it wasn't along, you know, 60 years ago. You read, say, mainstream American political economists like Robert Brady, important political economist, it's kind of Veblenite, back around the early 1940s, I guess. He wrote books about, you know, big business as a system of power, things like that, in which he points out, yeah, these things are basically totalitarian in structure, you know, which they are. So where'd they get their rights? Well, through courts and lawyers, by playing one state against one another. Incidentally, that's something worth thinking about when you listen to this devolution business now. The point of getting power down to the states is so that any business, even a middle-sized business, can make sure that the money goes into their pockets, not in the pockets of poor people. It's trickier to do it at the federal level. So that's why you get all this new philosophy about, you know, federalism and so on. Not that federalism would be bad, but, you know, not when you got private tyrannies around. This establishment of private corporate power is a dramatic example of that. Back, I forget exactly what year, but like early in this century, maybe around 1905 or something, the state of New Jersey figured it could make a killing by getting the big corporations to move from New York, where they always were, over to New Jersey, simply by giving them a lot of gifts. You know, it's kind of like when Alabama gets investment from Germany, you sort of, the taxpayers pay for it, but, you know, somebody makes a killing. And that's exactly what they did. So New Jersey gave corporations all sorts of, you know, gifts, essentially, to move across the river. And that's why you have so many things called, you know, Standard Oil of New Jersey and that sort of thing. Yeah, because they moved across the river so they could be incorporated there. And it's a lot cheaper for the big power because the taxpayers of New Jersey paid them. Delaware was another case. Well, of course, New York had to accommodate, you know, because everybody's moving across the river. That's the new federalism back at the early part of this century. So by such a mechanism, public funds did end up in big, deep private pockets, and corporations gradually got rights that they, you know, that are, in my opinion, totally illegitimate. Those rights can be taken away very simply, without a revolution. In fact, every corporation has a state charter, and they're supposed to be there for some public good, you know. Well, like it was true maybe 200 years ago. Like 200 years ago, we could like establish a corporation that would like build a bridge across the Charles River or something. Okay, that's what a corporation was supposed to be. It's changed a bit over the years. By now, they are huge tyrannies. I mean, bigger than states, involved in all kind of strategic interactions with one another in violation of any conceivable market principle and so on and so forth. There's no reason why they should exist. I don't think. And the media is just part of it. It's particularly harmful to democracy when media systems are in the hands of private tyrannies. I mean, it's bad enough if the guys who, you know, making shoes is or cars, that's bad enough. But when it's control over the doctrinal system and information, that's much worse. That's why I think the stuff that's going on in telecommunications now should really have a lot more attention than it does. I mean, here's this huge system, you know, built at public expense. I mean, you guys paid for it, you know. And as usual, being handed over to private power now that it's profitable. And it's very likely, I think most media analysts with their heads screwed on see, and indeed even report, that it's going to end up in the hands of a half a dozen megacorporations internationally. Well, that's worse than the oligopolies that run steel and computers, because here we're talking about a new mode of information and communication and so on, as always built at public expense, and right now, right in the middle of it, being handed over to private power, incidentally, not being reported. I mean, like, it's not that there's no reporting, like you've heard about the Telecommunications Act, but it wasn't discussed as a public interest issue. It was discussed as a business issue. And in fact, most of the reporting was in the business pages. This is the big legislative achievement of last Congress, you know, Telecommunications Act of 1996. Reported in the business pages, and not as a public interest issue. Like, it's not supposed to be a question of public interest, whether major systems of information and interchange are handed over as gifts to Rupert Murdoch. That's not supposed to be an issue of public interest. The only thing that was discussed was, like, do you give it to 6 corporations or 12, you know, or do you do it this way or that way? Well, you know, that's effective indoctrination when these ideas, when these things don't even occur to people. It takes real indoctrination. But yeah, I think you're right. This is worse than the handing over of decision-making power to private tyrannies, because in this case, it's also handing over, you know, access to the things that they're going to use for control of the public mind. These systems could also be used to liberate people.
Comment on educational systems, K-12, and the president has just adopted a bunch of good stuff, but there's still a lot of problems there.
Yeah, I'm not sure how good the good stuff is. The details haven't come out yet, but from the reporting that I've heard, and you know, I've read, maybe you know more, the actual proposals that are going to come along are going to be granting benefits of one kind or another to people of income levels kind of like mine, you know, people up to the level of like, you know, $80,000-$100,000 a year. Well, you know what, I forget the last figures, but I think the median income in the United States is something like around 30-some. Now, the idea of giving rich people special benefits so their kids can go to school, well, okay, who's paying? You know, well, the poor people are paying. So I'm not so sure it's such great stuff when you look at it. Same with other things. You know, the big investment firms, Lehman Brothers in this case, are now circulating brochures. Those of you who are wealthy enough must be receiving these things, you know. They're distributing brochures to their, you know, rich customers, telling them, look, we've taken over the health system, we've taken over the criminal system, you know, we're right now taking over the welfare system, we're enriching, here's a new way to enrich ourselves at public expense. They don't, not their words, you know, this is my translation. The way we will do it is by setting up EMOs, okay, educational management organizations, which will do wonders for the educational system like HMOs do for healthcare, about the same, in fact. Namely, they will be able to take more and more money away from the system and put it in private, you know, private power. Meanwhile, shaping care so that it mostly benefits the rich and harms everybody else. And now we can do it for the educational system, the last big government monopoly. I mean, it's not put this way. It's all put in terms of efficiency and what nice people we are, and we're going to make everything so better, much better for everyone, like, because we're just benefactors and so on. But go through it, and that's what it is. Yeah, I think those are probably the new plans that will be coming along. And I would be very cautious about the Clintons' proposals. Look at them really carefully. See to what extent they're lending themselves. After all, remember, he has made no secrets about what he is. I mean, he is and always has been a moderate Republican, candidate of the business community. He's never pretended to be anything else. You know, never pretended to be anything else. He's a business candidate. His main influence on the Democratic Party was to move it over to the Republican side with the Democratic Leadership Council. It's not like a secret or anything. He said it, you know, made it very clear. His record in Arkansas was like that. His influence in the national government was like that. So whatever the Democratic Party may have been, which you can sort of debate, it's now Like, if you can find a difference between Dole and Clinton, I'd like to know what it was. You know? I mean, a policy difference. They're both moderate Republicans. Incidentally, the business press is very well aware of this. I mean, take a look at the Wall Street Journal editorials the first couple of years, or reporting, throughout the whole Clinton years. I mean, at first they were a little nervous because he had some of this populist rhetoric. But pretty soon, within a few months, you start getting, you know, editorials in the Wall Street Journal and articles, in fact, not just editorials, about how Clinton is the best president business has ever had. You know, they quote the Ford company executive as saying, we're getting along with him much better than we did with Bush and Reagan, and on and on. Now, of course, you know, they'd prefer the Gingrich guys, actually with some ambiguity, I should say, because they don't like the small business aspect of the Gingrich people. There's a delicate balance there between holding off the crazies and making sure that the really rich people get everything. So there's been a problem. But as far as Clinton was concerned, they were perfectly happy with him. Yeah, he's a moderate Republican. I don't think you can say that he's deceived anyone. You know, if you look at his positions all the way along, they've been very clear. If people didn't want to see it, that's their choice. But it's been clear. It's been clear to the business press. It's been clear in his policies. Exactly what kind of education program would be crafted out of that, I'd be very suspicious about it. And I think it's worth a very careful look. I mean, there's plenty of problems with the educational system, but the main problem is that way too few resources go into it. Now, it's not that we don't have money, you know, like there's no budget crisis or anything like that. The country's just flooded with money. Again, read the business press. You know, it cannot find adjectives exuberant enough to describe, you know, the dazzling, stupendous profit growth and, you know, what are we going to do with all those funds and so on. The country's just flooded with money, capital, but all getting very narrowly concentrated, okay? There's plenty of money around to improve the educational system, and we know exactly where it has to come from. I think that's its main problem. I mean, teachers are way underpaid, you know. They're undereducated. They're not given enough respect. Too many kids in school, in a classroom, you know, not enough educational materials and so on and so forth. There's no special, you know, nobody has any brilliant ideas about, at least I never heard any, about how people should be educated, except, you know, kids' natural enthusiasm and creativity ought to be allowed to, you know, harness, work in constructive way. I mean, all this kind of stuff. You know. What's missing is the resources. Fine, so let's provide the resources. So maybe they won't have such dazzling and stupendous profits next year, and instead kids will get a better education. I think that's what ought to happen. But what I'm worried about is that the system is moving towards the kind of privatization which just imposes costs on the public. Remember, all this privatization you hear about, it's supposed to be very efficient. And by some measure, you know, by some ludicrous measure, it probably is efficient. You know, and the part of the reason why it's efficient is you don't count the costs, okay? So like suppose they're talking about privatizing the MTA around here, you know, the public transportation thing. All right, suppose you privatize the system. You and I know how to make it more efficient by the economist's measures. You throw out union workers and you get temps for half the price. And if there's an accident because they never had any training, well, it's just people who are getting killed. You don't measure that. And you cut off the so-called unprofitable bus routes, okay, or subway routes. Like, you don't make a lot of money at 11 p.m., okay, so let's throw them out. Well, suppose somebody's stuck somewhere at 11 p.m. and wants to get home. Oh, well, you know, it's entrepreneurial values, you know. Let them hire a limousine or something, you know. In ways like that, you can make the system more efficient simply by transferring the costs over to the public where you don't measure the costs, okay? So, you know, it looks nice and efficient on some economist's paper, but of course there's huge costs transferred over to the public which you don't measure. We all know this, and that's what privatizing the educational system will be. Also, it's doing something else. It's going after exactly that moral conception that underlies the labor movement from its origins. Namely, we're in it together. You know, it's not just gain wealth, forgetting all but self. Like we should care not only that my kid can go to school, but the kid down the street can go to school. That's what's being driven out of people's heads. You know, there's a very powerful effort to drive any of that out of people's heads. You're only supposed to care about yourself, unless you're rich, of course. If you're rich, you're part of big socialist structures called corporations with strategic alliances and plenty of support from the state, and then you're allowed to have all these feelings about, yeah, we work together, for us, the rich guys. But everybody else is supposed to be on their own. You know, you're not supposed to care whether the kid down the street goes to school. It's like breaking, it should be very familiar to people in the labor movement. This is the main propaganda against the labor movement all the time. I mean, right to work laws, everything else. You shouldn't work together. That's bad. If you work together, you might do something that matters. Okay? So just be out on your own, you know. And if you can get a voucher so maybe your kid can go to school, forget about everything else. I mean, look, this is a very much a business-run society, you know. I mean, about the last figures I saw, about $1 out of $6 in the whole economy is spent on marketing. It's an extremely inefficient use of funds, of course. Marketing doesn't produce anything, any public goods. But marketing is a form of manipulation and deceit. It's an effort to create artificial wants, you know, to put people, to control the way people look and think about things. A lot of that marketing is straight propaganda, advertising. Incidentally, most of it is tax-free, or a lot of it is tax-free, which means the way our system works, you pay for the privilege of being propagandized, you know, of having all this stuff dumped on you. Those are not small figures. That's like $1 trillion a year in 1992, something on that order. And yes, these when you've got that much of a commitment to controlling minds and manipulating desires and so on, and doing all the things they talk about in the public relations literature, I'm not making it up, you can read it there, and the social science literature, because this is also standard academic talk too. Well, you know, when you've got those stakes, you're going to work on it hard, and it's going to be hard to fight against. That's what makes organizing tough. It's not just, you know, well, you know way better than me, and I'm not going to talk about it, but you have to break through a lot of psychic resistance. The whole history of the labor movement tells you that. And as I say, this was well understood by Mill Hands and Lowell 150 years ago. But yeah, it's a big battle. And you're not just struggling against somebody who calls it a right to work act, you're struggling against 5 hours a day of television and the movie industry and the books and the schools and everything else. The scale of the efforts to win the battle for men's minds is enormous. I mean, I thought I knew something about this stuff, but when I read Elizabeth Fone's Wolf book, I was pretty shocked just to see the scale of the efforts. And the dedication, you know, the frenzied dedication to winning this everlasting battle. It's really pretty impressive, although if you think of the stakes, it's not too surprising.
I was curious about your remarks about the mill hands and Lowell, and maybe the best idea was for them to own the firms themselves.
Okay, let's just talk about the principle.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, the principle, as far as I can see, goes right back to the Enlightenment, you know. Like, if you go back to classical Enlightenment thought, I'm now talking about Adam Smith and, you know, Jefferson and those guys. The sort of core idea is that people have the right to control their own work, you know. Okay, that if a person, here I'll quote a standard formula back in the 18th century, you know, leading heroes of the Enlightenment, is if a person works on, if a person does beautiful work under external command, meaning for wages, we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is, because he's not a free human being. Okay, that goes all the way through classical liberal thought, Enlightenment thought. I mean, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville says, under wage labor, the art advances, the artisan declines. Now, you find this going right into the working class movements in Lowell and Lawrence. I think that's just natural. I wouldn't try to convince anybody of it. It seems to me if you think about it, yeah, why should you work on command? I mean, if you work on command, you're some kind of slave. You know? Why not work because it's coming out of your needs and interests? I mean, like, cheap for me to say, I'm in a fancy university in a science department and I can do that. One of the nice things about being in science as a fancy university is you really do have workers' control. To a very large extent, we control what we do. You know, want to work on this topic? I work on that topic. I mean, you got to sell it to funders and this and that. But the degree of workers' control at the elite level is quite substantial. I mean, that's why it's such a privilege to be in a science department. You know, enormously privileged existence. Forget the money. If they pay you 1/10 the amount of money, it would still be a much better existence than working on command. Now, I think people do know that. You know, I don't think that these Enlightenment ideas are hard to grasp. I think people know that if you work on under external control, you may despise, admire what the person does, but despise what he is, because his labor, you know, the sort of central part of your life, is being done at somebody else's orders. And you're not controlling the way it's done, or why it's done, or how it's used, or anything else. Well, you can't have every individual controlling every single thing, but that's why you have democratic structures, because people control things together, you know. Okay, I don't know how to, I wouldn't try to convince anybody of this, because I frankly just don't believe that everyone doesn't know it. I think maybe I'm sentimental, but it seems to me if you sort of cut away waves of, you know, layers of distortion and delusion, these things that were considered pretty obvious 200 years ago are still obvious.
What about the idea that the Cold War served certain ideological and political purposes for the U.S., and now the U.S. is seeking a new paradigm?
There's something true about the fact that the Cold War paradigm was extremely useful as a way of controlling people. So, like, say, take the labor movement. You know, one of the ways of controlling, undermining, and destroying the labor movement was weeding out the activist elements on the principle that they're somehow not loyal enough to the state at this time of, you know, when the enemy is at our throats. Well, like any propaganda, even the most vulgar propaganda that comes out of Stalinist Russia, there's always some thread of truth to it. You just couldn't have propaganda that doesn't have some, you know, marginal element of truth. And there was some marginal element of truth here, too, but it wasn't very real. It's like the Cuba case, you know. So, yes, this has been a very terrific hammer to use over people's heads. And it was understood, I should say. If you haven't read it yet, you should read NSC 68. Which was, everybody agrees, was the fundamental Cold War document. It's kind of interesting that its content, everybody recognizes it as the major document, but nobody quotes it, with very few exceptions. I'm one. But I have a book called Deterring Democracy, which in the first chapter has a lot of extensive quotes from NSC 68. It's April 1950. And it sort of laid out the basic picture of the Cold War, and it's quite fascinating to read. For one thing, because when you can see why diplomatic historians don't quote it. This was written by the real hotshots, you know, Dean Acheson, Paul Nitze, all these smart guys. It reads like a bunch of raving lunatics, you know. I mean, don't take my word for it. Read it. You know, I mean, I concede I picked out the most dramatic examples, but read the whole thing if you feel like it's not that long. In my view, it sounds like a bunch of raving lunatics, which is why nobody ever cites it. But they do make some points. I mean, the picture they tell is kind of like a fairy tale. You know, on one hand, there's absolute evil. That's the other side. It's kind of like a fairy tale you'd be embarrassed to read your grandchildren. There's this total absolute evil, you know, the Kremlin, this and that, which is planning to destroy the whole world and everything that ever existed and so on. On the other side, there's utter perfection. That's us. You know, we're like super angels. The only thing we ever do is work, you know, slave for the benefit of this and that. And it's portrayed in the picture of a, you know, an exaggerated, a parody of a fairy tale. There's never any evidence given because it's just like a matter of definition. They say it's an essential nature of the Kremlin that it acts this way. So you don't have to even give evidence because it's just part of their nature. And it's a central property of our nature that we do this sort of thing. Okay, so there's no evidence given. In fact, there is evidence scattered around, very carefully scattered around, so that anybody who's going to look for it is going to have a hard time finding it. And when you do put together the evidence I did in the same book, you find that it completely undermines whatever thesis they have about relative power. But forgetting that, then comes the proposals. The proposals are, we're involved in a real war. It's a real war. You know, the Cold War. We have to fight it like a war to prevent this monstrous thing from destroying everything and allowing utter perfection and magnificence to win. And in a war, you've got to have things like just suppression. We have to have suppression of dissent among us. One of our weaknesses is that we're too tolerant and too open and too free. They say that, you know, and that's a weakness. So we have to have just suppression and control of dissent and, you know, make sure that everybody's obedient and so on. And the way to do it is through, they also call for military Keynesianism. That means transferring public funds to private industry, which was a big issue then, because everybody knew that the economic system is not going to function without a tremendous amount of public funding, state funding poured in. So that was crucial. And that's true of the international economy, too, at that time, very heavily reliant on military spending to revitalize it. And they know all that, and it's laid out. But also that it would be an ideological weapon. It would be a weapon to control people. And that's true, it was. I mean, from then until the game started to go away in 1989, around then, it was a tremendous weapon of thought control. Anything you wanted to block, just yell, or do, you know, yell Cold War. Didn't matter how crazy it was. Sometimes there was some truth to it, sometimes not. So yes, you need a new paradigm, okay? Because how are we going to beat people over the head now that we don't have that around anymore? And if you look through the 80s, it was already obvious through the 1980s that this stuff is going to lose its efficacy. You didn't have to be a big genius to figure out that the Soviet Union was in trouble. So you look at stuff, say, I was writing since the early 80s, I've been saying, look, they're going to have to go to something else. And in fact, right through the 80s, there's an almost desperate search for something else. You know, international terrorism or crazed Arabs or Hispanic narco-traffickers or something or other that we have to defend ourselves against. Or otherwise, how are you going to control everybody? Okay, domestic crime, mostly manufactured. You know, U.S. doesn't have crime levels very different from other industrial countries. It doesn't, in fact, but has a very different perception of crime. Welfare queens, you know, sort of by implication black, driving around in Cadillacs and, you know, that sort of thing. So there's all sorts of effort to, you know, manufacture enemies for people to hate, but a foreign enemy is much better. Here's where the science of government comes in. Now, to get back to this clash of civilizations thing, Huntington's, you know, everybody is flailing around for some paradigm, you know, some big thing that you can use to control people. And Huntington's idea was clash of civilizations. So, you know, there's Islam and us and all these other things. And the reason why the reason why the world is so disorderly is because you've got all, you know, with the Cold War going, you've got all these ethnic groups killing each other and so on. Well, as usual, it's always a good idea to start by asking about the facts. Whenever you hear anything said very confidently, the first thing that should come to mind is, wait a minute, is that true? You know? So is it true? I mean, is it true that there's more ethnic conflict now than there was 20 years ago? Well, take a look. In most of the big conflicts that are going on around the world were going on right through the Cold War, like Burundi and Rwanda. There were huge massacres going on in the early 70s. Actually, I wrote about them at the time. Nobody was talking about them because it wasn't interesting. But they were there. Just about everyone you pick goes way back. Now, there are some that are new. Those within the former Soviet system, including Yugoslavia, you know, within the old so-called communist system, yeah, they're new. So like the war in Chechnya or, you know, Azerbaijan, Armenia, you know, Tajikistan, you know, these things are all new. But that's standard. Anytime a tyrannical system breaks down, you have all sorts of conflict internal to it. Just take a look at the breakdown of the European empires. Every single one was like that, and most of them were worse. So first of all, the factual basis is very thin. Now what about the principle, clash of civilizations? Like say, the big bad guy is Islam. Well, there are a few problems with that. The most fundamentalist Islamic state in the world is our big ally, Saudi Arabia. How's that fit? You know? I mean, Saudi Arabia is a real, it's not fundamentalist enough for some of the people in it, but it's pretty extreme. Are we trying to undermine Saudi Arabia? Of course not. They're sitting on all the oil, you know. In fact, they're our clients. That's a family dictatorship that we keep in power because they make sure that the money from oil doesn't go to the people of the region, but goes to London and New York. So they're okay. There's no clash of civilizations there. That's state fundamental. What about individual, you know, like not non-state? Well, by far the worst ones are the guys who are tearing Afghanistan to pieces. You find more crazy Islamic fundamentalists around than them. I don't know about them. Where'd they get their power from? Well, you know, your pocket, you know. They got $6 billion or so, it's claimed, from the United States and Saudi Arabia through the 1980s. Now they're tearing Afghanistan apart, but it's not our, you know, nothing that we did. You know, we're only wonderful people. So where is this clash of civilizations between Islam and the West? I don't see it. I mean, Indonesia is a Islamic state. Do you see us trying to undermine Indonesia? Yeah. I mean, in a lot of rotten things in Indonesia, like, for example, wages are about half the level of China, which is not so munificent. Do you see us doing anything about that? I mean, I think this is all farce. You know, I mean, I don't mean to say total farce. Like, there must be a new paradigm, you know, something that people can build their careers on and write books about and so on and so forth, which can then be turned into a device of controlling people. That part is true. And maybe this will work, or if it doesn't, you try something else.
You've been listening to a talk by Noam Chomsky, Propaganda and Control of the Public Mind, given at the Harvard Trade Union Program in 1997. Thanks to AK Press of San Francisco for this recording.
Born, I went home to watch my TV. Everyone was nice and the smiles were so sparkly. I watched what made them happy and I watched what made them cry. I learned about toys and candy my mommy should buy. And the TV God watches over me, opens up my eyes, shows me how to see. All around the world, every night and day, on my TV. Teaches how to love, teaches what is real, tells what life is of, tells me how to feel. All I need to know, I can find and see on my TV. Soon I was a teenager and I knew just how to dress. I learned to use deodorant so I would always smell my best. I got myself a part-time job to buy the things I needed to have. And the payments on my supercharged Camaro really aren't so bad. And the TV God watches over me, opens up my eyes, shows me how to see. All around the world, every night and day, on my TV. Teaches how to love, teaches what is real, tells what life is of, tells me how to feel. All I need to know, I can find and see on my TV.
Everybody be careful, everybody be very careful, keep watching your TV. There are people who are laughing when they wink or a nod. There are people who are questioning our great TV God. Everybody be careful, everybody be very careful, stay tuned to your TV. There are ponies who are talking, there are wasters who read. There are people here who do not even own a TV. Everybody be careful. Oh, everybody be careful. Oh, everybody be careful.
Everything I know about my country, I learned on TV. The man on the screen tells me who is our enemy. They say that we are free and we must fight to be number one. So when the army calls, I'll grab my TV, my car and my gun. And the TV God watches over me, opens up my eyes, shows me how to see. All around the world, every night and day, on my TV. Teaches how to love, teaches what is real, tells what life is of, tells me how to feel. All I need to know, I can find and see on my TV.
This This is Money, Media, and the Left Liberal Role in Plutocratic Elections by Edward S. Herman. In many ways, the system is working beautifully right now. First of all, money dominates the initial selection and weeding out of presidential candidates, so that only those who will serve the corporate interest on the basics, advancing free trade, keeping the lid on or shrinking the welfare state, preserving and strengthening the military establishment, and pursuing the ongoing imperial strategies, can qualify as credible and electable. While there is a fair amount of grumbling about soft and hard money and the essentiality of big bucks for election status, the mainstream media normalize this and accept the process as entirely legitimate, and the public, or at least half the public, also goes along and participates with their vote. As part of the normalization process, the media argue vociferously that the two candidates on the take offer adequate options, have sufficient and important differences, so that nobody else even needs to be heard by the public. The New York Times made the first point in its editorial of August 20th, Two Visions of Government, where it contested Ralph Nader's claim that there are no meaningful differences between Gore and Bush, arguing that there are, quote, measurable differences on how to deploy federal resources that, quote, may not be enough to satisfy Mr. Nader's aggressively populist inclinations, but if the election were held now, they would give the voters a real choice, end quote. So if the editors are satisfied with the choices offered by Gore and Bush, the general public should be as well. No aggressive populism need enter the lists. I wonder if there is such a thing as an aggressive centrism or an aggressively pro-corporate agenda. The Times has supported this position by completely marginalizing Nader and Buchanan as well, refusing to allow him to make his case while inundating its readers with trivia on the money election candidates. Effectively, they declared Nader's candidacy illegitimate and by their fiat ruled him out of contention. Then, in its editorial of August 22nd, Stop Arguing and Start Debating, after having refused to allow Nader to make his substantive case and develop any constituency, the paper justified Nader's and Buchanan's exclusion from the debates on the ground that they had no, quote, demonstrated national support. This is a remarkable combination of media authoritarianism and chutzpah. Of course, the rest of the mainstream media did the same as the Times, producing a self-fulfilling prophecy of lack of mass support by marginalization and some degree of trashing. In the abysmal Philadelphia Inquirer, their chief election commentator Larry Eichel finally devoted a column to Nader entitled, "The Bench is the Key," with subtitle, "Democrats Call Ralph Nader Dishonest for Discounting the Supreme Court as an Election Issue." Eichel himself had never discussed Supreme Court appointments as a key issue or indicated any dissatisfaction with a Bush win in this regard. But for the sake of disposing of Nader, he effectively turns his column over to Gore protagonists to make what they believe is their strongest case against Nader, with no Nader right to reply. Nader is not only declared to be wrong, he is dishonest for disagreeing with a Gore support position. The last time Eichel was strenuously upset over election candidates was back in 1987-1988, when the populist threat of Jesse Jackson caused him to depart from his usual focus on horse racing and take some nasty swipes at that earlier deviant. But the beauty of this system is most manifest in the reaction of liberals and leftists to the moneyed versus principled and populist candidates. It is an all-or-nothing election, and there is always the argument for the Democratic lesser evil. So in each election, we see vast liberal-left abandonment of the principled and populist in favor of the lesser evil. As with the media's process, we have another contribution to a self-fulfilling prophecy. Remember the allegation that business corporations have too short a time horizon? Could this not be said of the liberals and leftists who jump on the lesser evil bandwagon? Maybe this is a national trait. A number of liberals and leftists have argued vigorously that a vote for Nader is virtually immoral, given the differences between Gore and Bush and the costs of a wasted vote. But the counter-immorality position seems to me more potent. A classic moral rule laid down by Immanuel Kant was his categorical imperative: act in a way that you would want generalized. If you act on the basis of calculating what others are likely to do, this can not only assure an immoral result, it erodes the basis of moral action altogether. Furthermore, as I watched Clinton in action in Colombia, enlarging exactly the kind of policies this country carried out in Guatemala and El Salvador, and putting more pressure again on Iraq and implementing the most genocidal policy carried out in recent times, and competing with the Republicans and urging an increase in, quote, defense, I am intrigued by the ability of liberals and leftists to consider candidates and parties supporting these actions as legitimate authority. Could they vote between candidates on the basis of their offering different rates of incineration in gas chambers? If living in Yugoslavia, could they vote for Milosevic as a lesser evil if his opponent was even worse than he? Part of the answer gets us back to the power of the mainstream media and the virtual absence of a left media. Voting for Milosevic would be tough because his badness has been driven home thousands of times, with photos of streams of refugees, women and children in pain, dead bodies, and supportive analyses, accusations, and war crimes tribunal indictments. Clinton Gore have been responsible for far more suffering in Iraq, East Timor, and Turkey, among other places. See Chomsky's New Military Humanism, Chapter 3, or My Clinton is the World's Leading Active War Criminal from Z Magazine, December 1999. And if there were photos of the victims, weeping women and children, generous details of the terror, analyses of the source of the criminal behavior, indignant charges, and war crimes indictments proportional to the victimization for which Clinton Gore bear heavy responsibility, I suspect that the lesser evil's contingent's numbers would quickly erode. I think even honest reporting of the pain of the hungry and homeless folks empowered by the 1996 Personal Responsibility Act and the condition and histories of the prisoners victimized by the drug war would take a heavy lesser evil toll. In short, I find myself unable to accept the candidacies of spokespersons for the ongoing range of policies and must protest these horrors in some manner. Joel Bleifuss in These Times tells us to vote for Gore because it is important that we win this one first. Joel seems to think that we will win if Gore wins, despite the Clinton-Gore record and Gore's selection of Lieberman. I feel that we will lose if Gore, Lieberman, or Bush-Cheney win, and if Gore, Lieberman do win, and Al Fromm and the more pro-business-than-thou crowd of the DNC consolidate their position in the Democratic Party, where is political change supposed to come from in the future? That was a commentary by Edward S. Herman entitled The Money, Media, and the Role of the Liberal Left in Plutocratic Elections. Ed Herman is a professor at the Wharton School of Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. TV God was composed and performed by Dana Lyons.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Always be filled by unwelcome travelers.